Hello, Capital Region. This is Hudson Mohawk Magazine on WOOCLP 105.3 FM in Troy and WOOSLP 98.9 FM in Schenectady. Broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, I'm Livonia Mallory, and I'm still on my couch.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, coming to you from my living room. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Alexis Goldsmith speaks with Morley Music about incarcerated individuals who are released from Rikers Island without their belongings, including their IDs. Then Spencer Keevil speaks with Tianhong Mu about her research on the removal of PFOA and PFOS from water. After that, on Indigenous Voices, Anna speaks with Clayton Bracoupe, Then on As the World Turns, host Erica Dulcinea Diggs speaks with meteorologist Hugh Johnson about California wildfires and our upcoming winter. And to close out the show, we'll be speaking with Joe Ritchie, executive director of Saratoga Sites Against Norlite Emissions, about next Tuesday's Norlite Town Hall. But first, here are the headlines.
As of 6 p.m. Friday, Vice President Joe Biden holds a narrow lead over President Donald Trump, though the president continues to threaten legal action. While the Republicans hold a two-seat majority in the Senate, control of the body will be decided in a two-seat runoff election in Georgia in January.
The Times Union reports that John Sweeney, dubbed Congressman Kickass by former President George W. Bush, for his role in organizing a riot to stop the vote counting in Miami in the 2000 election, is now assisting President Donald J. Trump's efforts to challenge the integrity of the 2020 elections in Pennsylvania, Nevada, Wisconsin, and other states. Sweeney, who was in Pennsylvania on Thursday, accused the Democrats of manufacturing votes and denying Republicans from observing the vote counting. He acknowledged that his accusations are lacking hard evidence.
The New York State Liquor Authority confirmed that it's investigating possible violations of COVID-19 protocols at an election night party held by congressional candidate Liz Joy at the Republicans' indoor event at Riverstone Manor. Most attendees did not wear masks while they were talking, eating, and drinking together.
And the Times Union reports that the National Transportation Safety Board on Thursday issued its final report on the horrific limousine crash that killed 20 people 2 years ago in Schoharie County. The board offered up scathing criticism of the State Department of Transportation and State Department of Motor Vehicles and their inability to shut down Prestige Limousine, the illegal limousine operation involved in the crash. The 103-page report cited egregious disregard for safety by Prestige, which had rented out its 30-foot white Ford Excursion limo despite having previously been ordered to take the Excursion off the road following two failed DOT safety inspections. The DMV was also blamed for its lack of oversight in state inspection stations, such as the Mavis Discount Tires in Saratoga Springs, which provided the Excursion with an improper inspection sticker, even though it had been cited for numerous safety violations.
For those of you just tuning in, you're listening to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, coming to you from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy.
And our mission here is to use art and participatory action to promote social and environmental justice and freedom of creative expression. This program is produced by community members and funded in part by monthly donations from Sanctuary sustainers. To learn how you can contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org, that's @mediasanctuary.org, or call us at 518-272-2390, that's 518-272-2390. HMM's Alexis Goldsmith interviews Morley Music, an editor for the nonprofit digital publication New York Focus. He recently wrote an investigative piece about New Yorkers who are released from Rikers Island Correctional Facility without any form of legal identification.
We're joined now by Morley Music. He's a reporter and editor for New York Focus, who recently wrote a piece, Recently Jailed New Yorkers Struggle When Dumped on Street with No ID. Welcome to the show, Morley.
Thanks for having me.
So, Morley, tell us about New Yorkers who are incarcerated in New York City, who then are, quote, dumped on the street with no ID.
Sure. Lots of people get arrested in New York, and the police confiscate their wallets and might claim that they need the wallets as evidence. Sometimes the courts take them, or sometimes they get them back. And but then when they get incarcerated, you know, mostly at Rikers Island, there's a lot of things that can go wrong, such that when they leave and are, you know, trying to resume their lives, they don't get their wallets and, most importantly, their ID back, which causes just a whole host of ridiculous and serious obstacles to thriving after incarceration that I go into in my article.
How is it that people, when they are released, don't get their personal items back?
I think a lot of different things go wrong. And that was always the hardest piece to figure out, because there's not data that people keep. But sometimes their wallets are kept as evidence. Sometimes they're moved from one jail to another in a different borough, and their things don't come with them. Sometimes their wallet is taken from them at the precinct, and then it's not moved to Rikers Island. And then when they go back to get it from the precinct, the precinct doesn't have it, or the precinct moved it to central booking. And, you know, there's an expiration date on how long they keep things. So I think for all those reasons, and sometimes they just release people from Rikers Island, I understand it, without telling them how to get their stuff. So it's not even an issue of them losing it or moving it, but people simply don't know the building on the island that they need to go to.
And how, do we have any data on how often this happens, that a person is released without their ID?
No, it's not something that anyone tracks, but the estimates that I got were all in the, most people said in the thousands, but it was conjectural. And I should be clear that the thousands figure actually encompasses people who didn't have ID to begin with. So, I mean, that's also another issue. But the bottom line is, if you get released from jail and you did have ID to begin with and then you didn't, or you didn't have ID to begin with, just the reentry process is going to be exponentially harder. So, but yeah, people estimated in the thousands, some the high hundreds. And yeah, that's about as best as I could do on that part.
And which groups does this affect the most?
I mean, it's the same groups that, you know, get incarcerated. So poor people, you know, it's predominantly poor people of color. So
if a person is released from Rikers Island or another facility without their ID, what happens next?
So there can be a lot of different things. One of the main things is that your government benefits are turned off on your incarceration. So if you're on Medicaid or food stamps, those benefits are both turned off, and you need ID to reactivate Medicaid, and you need if it's your first, and sorry, if you don't need ID to reapply to resume a new case for food stamps, I believe. But if you're applying for the first time out of jail, and you probably will need that support, because presumably you're not going to get a job right away, and a lot of people don't have money, you do need ID for that. So right off the bat, the kinds of benefits that you would need upon incarceration are very hard to get. Like one of the people I interviewed who'd been affected by this issue, you happen to be carrying all your ID on you, as some people do, for various reasons, and it's all taken away from you and you don't get it, there's a really crazy process that can last for months where you kind of need to parlay one form of ID to get another. And if you don't have any to begin with, this guy simply got a forged ID in a kind of wacky scheme involving a fake dentist. And he got a forged ID with his real information and used that to get his, I'm not going to remember the order, but I think he used that to get his birth certificate. And then he used that in his fake to get his social security. And then he had everything he needed to get his ID. But meanwhile, you know, he's homeless, can't apply for a job because he doesn't, you know, he doesn't have ID. And he can't activate his, any government benefits. So that those are the kinds of consequences. Yeah.
So this person had to go to extreme lengths to get his legal IDs back by, you know, as your article explains, he had no choice but to get a forged ID to get his real identification back. But you also talk about in the article how when you're incarcerated, you have a prison ID.
Right.
Can you talk about why it is that you can't get a legal ID even though you have a prison ID within the system?
Right. So this is a very bizarre thing. And I should be clear about distinguishing between prisons and city jails. So New York City's IDNYC program accepts ID cards, counts ID cards towards getting an IDNYC. So if you're released from a state prison, if you're incarcerated for a longer amount of time and for a more serious crime, you can use the ID card from a state prison to get a city ID. And that city ID is extremely valuable. It helps you apply for jobs. It helps you apply for benefits. It's huge. But the city, for bizarre bureaucratic reasons that I don't fully understand, does not accept IDs produced in its own jails. So city jails, as distinct from state prisons, also make IDs, but those IDs don't count towards the city's own ID program. And the anonymous staffer that I, DOC staffer, Department of Corrections staffer that I spoke with, had worked on this issue for a number of years, and they had said, basically, the IDNYC office thinks that the state is better at verifying people's identities, and that's why they accept cards from prisons, state prisons, but not city jails. But they basically said there's no reason to think that they're any better at that. And, you know, really the city just needs to accept jail IDs in its own ID program.
Can you talk about the advocates that are working on this issue, the faith communities for just reentry, and what they recommend as a solution?
Right. So I think the most effective solution by far would simply be to issue everyone leaving jail with an IDNYC card, which might on its face sort of sound like a difficult thing to do. And for bureaucratic reasons, there certainly would be hurdles, but there's also just the sort of crazy thing, which is like there were all kinds of, you know, identity verification processes that happened to incarcerate you, you know, as you went through the courts, right? Like they were pretty sure who you were when you got incarcerated. So they have a lot of information on you already that could be used to just print IDs. And prisons in other states have DMV machines that do this. So it's not unprecedented. And, you know, knowing that a lot of people lack ID to begin with or are going to have an inordinately difficult time getting their ID back, it seems like the least you can do to set people back on the, you know, on their own two feet is just to print it. So that's the main, and I think would be the most effective solution. And then the other main demand on this particular issue is simply to get the city's IDNYC program to accept city jail IDs. There was a generally broader sort of strategic point that the former DOC staffer brought up, which I think is a really important one, which is that the city and generally our prison systems invest a lot of money and a lot of time into these character reform initiatives, kind of getting people to examine who they are in jail and in prison, but not really as much on just the sort of bread and butter basic things you need to survive immediately after you are released that can help you get money and feed yourself and put a roof over your head. All of which, if you can't do it easily, you might need to commit crimes that put you at risk of going right back where you started. So there's some very basic bureaucratic things that could be coordinated here instead of investing so much into trying to change people, just, you know, actually properly set them up. Yeah, I think that's the sort of broader theme that I think is important to note.
This has been Morley Music. He's a reporter and editor for New York Focus. Thank you for joining us on HMM, Morley.
Thanks so much for having me. Have a good one.
That was Morley Music, editor of the nonprofit digital publication New York Focus, on New Yorkers who are released from incarceration without their personal items, including ID. Read the full piece at nysfocus.com.
Next, in the fifth installment of Spencer Keeble's Public Health Local series, Tianhong Mu describes her research on the removal of PFOA and PFOS from water via electrocoagulation. Tianhong is a doctoral student with the Environmental and Sustainable Engineering Department at the University at Albany.
My name is Tianhong Mu, and it's my third year for study for my PhD degree in environmental and sustainable engineering in Albany. And my research is about removal of PFOA and PFOIs from water by electrocoagulation. And my advisor is Dr. Kim.
So you presented on the safety of PFOA and PFOS in Teflon and Scotchgard. So can you give us a little information about what Teflon and Scotchgard are and what we need to know about them?
Teflon and Scotchgard, we concern is the PFOA and the PFOIs. Well, before they use these components when they in their manufacture process, and after 2013, they phased out PFOA and PFOS. But PFOA and PFOS, they are very persistent. So even though they were already phased out, it continually exists in the environment because they are not naturally degradable. So now people focus on the study how to remove those persistent pollutants from the environment. And for my research, I just study for how to remove it from water and wastewater.
Well, that's really great research to do because New York State just recently passed regulations for drinking water for those compounds, PFOA and PFOS. So can you describe in simple terms the research you're doing for electrocoagulation?
Yes. My research is removal of the PFOA and PFOS by electrocoagulation. And the electrocoagulation is a electrochemical process that removes heavy metals, suspended solids, and organics and other contaminants from water. When we apply the electricity power on the electrode, so on one electrode is generate metal ions, and on the other electrode is generate hydroxide, and the metal hydroxide is a flux. It can absorb contaminants, then settle down on the bottom. So that's how it works. Well, actually, electrocoagulation has been found for a long time, but before it's costly because it's need power, and but now we are trying to save the energy, so we try to make it not that expensive, and we try to save energy and to see how if it can be applied in the industrial process. So now we try to improve the technology, like we use new cathode and anode, and to see if we can save energy from like aeration or others. So hopefully it's inexpensive, and hopefully it can be applied in our real life. And I should say it's a efficiency technology, because in my lab research, I can the results I can see is that the electrocoagulation can remove PFOA and PFOS about 90% in just 1 hour. So I can say it's a very efficient to remove PFOA and PFOS.
So in the lab, you're finding that there's very high removal efficiency, and you're trying to improve the energy efficiency of the process because it uses electricity?
Yes. In the lab, I can see it's a remove about 90% of the PFOA and PFOS from the water. And now I try to reduce the energy, because if the energy is high consumable, so this technology should be costly. So if we can use less energy and it costs less, so that's what I'm studying. I am trying to get a high removal, and on the other side, I try to use less energy.
And so you're hoping that your lab scale experiments can scale up to a wastewater treatment facility level size?
Yes, I think it's a long way to go, I should say, because now in my lab, the reactor is small. It's about 10 milliliter reactor. So we need more study and more experiment to see how to scale it up.
Well, it's exciting initial findings so far. Is there anything else you want us to know about PFOA or PFOS or your research at removing them from water?
Well, there are several options. So one option is how to improve our reactors and how to improve the technology. So other option is after removal, the PFOA and the PFOS from the water, we have the flux absorb them. And how could we treat those flux? It's another topic. So there are several topics we should go, and all of them need more studies.
Yeah, what you're studying is electrocoagulation, so it would cause the PFOA to basically fall out of the water in a flop.
Yes.
And then you'd still have to do something with it after. And so that's need for more study.
Yes.
Okay. Well, thank you, Tianhong, for joining us today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Thank you.
That was the fifth installment of Spencer Keeble's Public Health Local series with UAlbany doctoral student Tianhong Mu describing her research on the removal of PFOA and PFOS from water via electrocoagulation.
Breaking news from the Independent at Philadelphia ballot processing location was evacuated after an individual called Philadelphia police saying that a bomb was going to go off. The ballots are being processed at the convention center. K-9 units are sweeping the center and trains in the area have been halted. Biden's vote count in Pennsylvania surpassed President Trump overnight. Winning Pennsylvania would ensure Biden a victory. For those of you just tuning in, I'm Livonia Mallory.
And I'm Guy Schaefer, and you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community, and is supported by independent donations. We thank all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. You can hear all about the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org. And up next on As the World Turns, HMM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs speaks with meteorologist Hugh Johnson about California's wildfires and getting ready for a brutal winter.
Okay. This is HM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs, and I'm speaking with retired meteorologist Hugh Johnson for his show As the World Turns for segment 13. How are you doing today, Mr. Johnson?
I'm doing good. Now that I can see you, it's been a while since I've actually seen you, so it's kind of nice to see a face again, and that's great.
Aw, thank you. Same here, same here. I miss our in-person meetings.
Yes, in February.
Yes, yes. All right. So, Mr. Johnson, I can't believe tropical storms are happening in the Atlantic. Fascinating. Tell me about that. And do you ever see the hurricane season finally shutting down?
Okay. Well, Erica, yeah, we're not quite done yet. We've long passed the Cape Verde season. That's been gone for about a month. But at this time of year, and considering how warm the Atlantic and Caribbean basin is, I'm not surprised we're getting additional storms. This is not the latest we've ever had a tropical storm, but one's hitting the New Orleans area as of October 27th. It's going to either hit as a category 1 or 2. And something to think about, that everyone talks about Katrina, how horrible it was, absolutely horrible for New Orleans. It had actually weakened to a high-end category 2 by the time it hit New Orleans, but the tidal surge and the breaching of the levees is what, of course, hit the city. And I'm not trying to scare people, but it could be a little bit of a problem there. But anyways, that's our 27th storm of the year. 5 of them have hit Louisiana. That's pretty amazing in itself. But keep in mind that the tropical season does not officially end until November 30th. That is correct. But that doesn't always stop tropical storms from happening. In fact, in 06, we had tropical storms into January. So I have a feeling that, you know, the bulk of the year season's behind us, but we may still have 1 or 2 after Zeta. There's hints on one of the models. It could be one early in November. We'll see. We'll just have to see how that goes. But yeah, it's been a very active season, but we're still 4 behind the record of 31 storms named storms in 2005 and 6.
Sounds promising.
Oh, by the way, Zeta will probably give us some weather, will definitely impact our weather later this week, and rain and possibly snow. We might actually have to take the shovels out, maybe.
Wow.
All right. Yeah. Hopefully not a lot, because we don't want that to the leaves on the trees while power outages. Hopefully we'll get by without any major problems.
Definitely. So please tell me, the California fires are winding down. What's the deal with that?
Well, yes and no. Northern California and Washington, Oregon, they have wound down. They've had some rain out there and cooler temperatures. But guess what? Now we got them in Southern California, Orange County down towards San Diego and L.A. very, very active ones. We have already, in California, they've already seen 4.1 million acres burned, which is more than double the record set just 2 years ago. This is climate change stuff. I mean, to have this kind of incredible difference in record, you know, and they're still raging. They're still raging in Southern California. And then in Colorado, they got a whole bunch last week and the week before near Fort Collins, they had a record setting wildfire and a couple more close to Boulder. My sister lives in Boulder, so obviously I had personal concern. The good news is they had a snowstorm on Sunday. Temperatures were in the teens, and that pretty much put the kibosh on, at least temporarily, on the fires. However, drier weather is returning there, and I wouldn't be surprised if they keep flaring up again. So we're not out of the wildfire season at all. We've still got a ways to go.
Okay. And any updates on the Albany thermometer?
Yes, we do have an update. October 15th, my former boss sent me what's considered a public statement, meaning that anybody can access it on the internet. But basically, it said that they installed a new thermometer, an ASOS thermometer at the Albany International Airport, and they acknowledged the other one was cold, reading cold, 3 degrees cold. The kind of bad news is that I've been following it like a hawk since, and it still seems to be running a couple degrees cold. And a friend of mine just texted me from Niskayuna. He has a thermometer at home, and he thinks that it's running cold as well, especially in the afternoon. Now, my morning temperatures have always been slightly warmer than the airport because I'm closer into the city, a little bit on a hill. So that was, but the afternoon temperature is consistently 3 degrees warmer. Right now, I'm 2 degrees warmer. I checked it on October 27th at noon. I was 2 degrees warmer than the airport. But the point is, I think there's still a problem, and there's still the bigger problem. Are they ever going to correct the climate? The climate, it's been tarnished since mid-July. I think we discussed that last time. Mm-hmm. And it really infuriates me because it's almost like they're just brushing it off.
Bypassing it, yeah.
So we'll see. I'll reach out and send a note to my ex-boss. He usually gets back to me. We'll see what he says.
And where do you see the world climatologically in 10 years?
I do not see a good picture. I mean, well, again, not to get political, but we'll see. I'm hoping the election goes the way we think it is. But even if it does, I'm not sure enough's going to be done to reverse this trend, because even if we do everything correctly in this country and really go to the green energy that we promised to do in the next 10 or 15 years, other countries are not always following suit, like India and Russia and China particularly, or they stick out, maybe even to an extent Mexico, but and even Germany and Western Europe, their energy level is, and we talked about this, I think last time, not very, very good per capita and all that. But the point is, I could see us warming another half a degree to maybe close to a full degree Celsius. That'd be the worst case scenario. And keep in mind, and I'm a firm believer in this, that extinctions occur when temperatures drop or rise 8 degrees Celsius from where they are, where they have been for the last hundreds of years. That's when you have to start worrying about having mass extinctions. We're already seeing a lot of species that are not making it already. But, you know, by 8 degrees, it's catastrophic. I'm not saying we're anywhere near there, but it could accelerate, because in 10 years, I mean, we lucked out this year. We didn't quite lose the Arctic ice because it cooled off just enough towards the tail end of the season. But one of these years, we're going to lose it all. We're going to lose it all for a few months. And when that happens, you're going to release some more methane. You're going to increase the warming, because there'll be less reflection albedo going on, and it's going to just accelerate. So if we don't change, if we keep going our merry way right now as we stand, I'd say we'll warm at least half a degree Celsius in 10 years and maybe closer to a degree. Let's hope not, but that's the way it could go.
What animal do you think is next on the list for extinction? What animal is next?
Well, maybe the polar bear. I don't know. I mean, I've heard different things about them, that they're hurting a lot. You know, of course, a lot of people are like, polar bears, what are they needed for? Well, you know, it's all the ecosystem. They eat certain types of fish. And I mean, there's just, you know, the balance that has been there, it's going to be altered. So that would be my guess offhand. I'm not an expert on that, but, they're definitely in danger. So maybe they will be the next one.
This is part one of a two-part segment.
That was HMM correspondent Erica Dulcinea Diggs speaking with meteorologist Hugh Johnson. Next up, HMM producer Anna Steltenkamp speaks with Clayton Brock-Pay. Clayton is a lifelong gardener and farmer. He is also the program director of the Traditional Native American Farmers Association, or TNAFA, which is a nonprofit intertribal organization of indigenous farmers, gardeners, educators, and health professionals whose mission is to revitalize traditional agriculture for spiritual and human need by creating awareness and support for Native environmental issues. This is the second segment in a multi-part dialogue with Mr. Brockupay.
My name is Clayton Brockupay. I'm the program director for the Traditional Native American Farmers Association. We're based here in Santa Fe, New Mexico, and I live and work and farm in the Pueblo of Tizuque, which is just north of Santa Fe.
Will you speak a little bit to how working the land, working within the natural cycles of reciprocity, having a productive role within your natural landscape makes you personally feel?
Yeah. Like I was saying, you know, we practice a biological approach, an organic approach to our farm, meaning we, you know, try to do our best to improve the water, improve the land itself, try not to, degrade any of the elements that we utilize in the productions in our fields. And I guess the satisfaction we receive from that practice is knowing that the next generation will inherit better soils, hopefully, better seeds, and clean water. There's a satisfaction in knowing that, but also the sharing, I guess, the exchange of knowledge, and to continue that practice is, for me, satisfying. The other aspect of that whole part of it is what we see in conventional agriculture is that they're always looking at production values, like X amount of pounds or X amount of bushels per acre or whatever like that. That's what their main goal is, I guess.
Mm.
In ours, we're looking at not only production wise, but also, I guess, nutritional value per acre.
Mm.
And a lot of times I haven't seen people studying that as much as, say, pounds per acre. Like I was saying earlier, the older varieties of corns, beans, and pumpkins and like that do have a higher nutritional value to it. So, there's a satisfaction knowing that what we are producing is of a higher quality, perhaps better flavor, mm-hmm. and that we haven't, ripped off the soils and polluted waters in that production.
Would you say that working with nature, for example, in the field, creates a different sense of connection with the natural world than, for example, just hiking or sitting in nature, that the act of productively doing something creates a different experience?
Yeah, I believe so, because and you can talk with a lot of other farming people, especially organic farming people. You know, there's a more acute awareness of what's happening around you, but also in your fields. You know, you notice things like the types of birds that are around, the benefit they may play in your field,
mm.
because a lot of birds do eat insects,
mm.
and any change in the weather, you know, you're acutely aware of. It's like every day you look at the clouds early morning, mid-afternoon, and in the evening. You're looking at which way the wind is shifting, temperature, I guess, relative humidity. Even the insects within your field, too.
Mm-hmm.
Some are going to be very beneficial to you. Some are going to be, you know, create some problems for you, and you try to find that balance. You just become more aware of everything that's happened around you, not only just in your fields, but also the surrounding areas. We have other animals that visit our fields, like deer and elk. And this year it was raccoons that were visiting our fields, and then you try to address how best to address those visitations, I guess. So, it's just trying to find, I'll say, a healthy relationship with all of nature. Some are there to, might take a little bit of your produce, your production. And in really drought years, we've had some of the the elk actually, I would say they took more than their share. But also, as human beings, I guess, and we have to weigh, I guess, benefit and loss too with their presence, So, yeah, it's, just being very aware of everything that's going in and around you. Oh, yeah, the other part is, we stay aware of moon cycles, full moons, new moons, and that process in everything. This year, we did get visited by elk primarily, and we're noticing that they only visited our fields either very close to the new moon, or a few days after the new moon. They like to move around in the dark, I guess. And so we were able to modify our activities to kind of minimize their presence in our fields.
So through your work on the land, you've become more attuned to both the cycles of the natural world and also begun to or continue to understand the world, the natural world, more so as like this holistic cycle. Like, as you said, it's not just your land, but also understanding what's going on all around you.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good way of putting it together. And I'm not sure, what other activity besides farming or ag that would give you that same experience.
That was HMM correspondent Anna Stilton Camp speaking with Clayton Barkape, Program Director of the Traditional Native American Farmers Association.
Lights Out Norlight and Saratoga Sites Against Norlight Emissions, or SANE, are corresponding and or co-sponsoring an online Norlight Town Hall on Tuesday, November 10th at 7 p.m. to discuss the Norlight Bill with legislators and stakeholders. To register for this event, you can go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at info@mediasanctuary.org. We're joined now by Joe Ritchie, Executive Director of SANE. Welcome to HMM, Joe. It's so great to have you on here.
Thanks for having me. Always fun.
Can you tell us about the focus of Tuesday's town hall?
So yeah, the focus of Tuesday's town hall is to raise awareness and to ask questions about the McDonnell-Breslin bill that was passed unanimously back in June. And this bill would prohibit AFFF incineration at the Norlight Incinerator in Cohoes, New York. And we have invited Assemblymember McDonald, State Senator Breslin, and also the EC Commissioner, Basil Sago. CINDI EC stands for the Department of Environmental Conservation. And I will also be speaking. And we're just trying to raise awareness about the bill and see where it's at.
Why are you holding this town hall, and what can attendees expect?
Well, we really want to get this bill passed. We really want to raise awareness about Norlight and also about the surrounding areas, which are, significantly lower income, and they're not really looked at as much in regards to when it comes to government help or just community outreach. And we just really want to say, have people here for generations. We've been overlooked. We finally had something done unanimously back in June. Please, Governor Cuomo, sign this bill. And we've been having a lot of pushback from the Cuomo administration in regards to revisions that they want to make. And we're here, and I'm here to say, and I think Senator Breslin and McDonald are saying that we don't want this stuff to happen. We want the bill to be passed as is, and we want it to be a ban on AFFF incineration.
So, can you tell us a little bit about what's been going on with the Norlight bill? You just mentioned that Cuomo has been trying to maybe cut off some of the more important parts of it. What kinds of what kinds of revisions have been proposed?
So yeah, so I've heard that the Cuomo administration really wants to put this bill to be a statewide moratorium on AFFF incineration, which honestly sounds fine if you're not too keen to what that might mean. But to really decipher what that means is actually, it gives the GEC authority to say, okay, you can burn this at Norlite because we have evidence to suggest that it's okay. Or no, you can't burn it because there's no evidence to suggest it's okay. And from the very beginning, DEC has been wanting to burn this stuff. They burned it illegally for 2 years, burning approximately 2 million pounds and thus contaminating the surrounding neighborhoods, which again are very poor neighborhoods. So we really just want to say, no, we want a ban. Because a ban would just say, you know what, even if there's evidence to suggest that it's okay, you still can't do it because there's just so much uncertainty. And, you know, I'm willing to make a compromise on it and say, you know, let's make it a statewide ban if you want to make it statewide, not a moratorium, because that's not that's unacceptable. And the people of Saratoga Sites and the surrounding areas, they just don't have any, there's no more compromise. We've been at this for 50 years. We're not compromising. We're not moving an inch.
So Joe, I'm sorry, Joe, this is Livonia. What motivated you to get started with this fight?
Well, what motivated me to get started with this fight is I've lived at Saratoga Sites, which is a public housing complex. I've lived there for 20 years, my whole life. And I've always seen on my windowsills black soot. I've always seen my neighbors coughing. I've always seen people's property being completely damaged by the effects of Norlite soot. If you ask neighbors who have lived in the area for 80 plus years, it's the cleanest that their property has ever been. So it's really about human rights, and it's really about maintaining a quality of the air that we deserve. We should have the same air quality as somebody living in a rich neighborhood 5 miles away. And we just don't. And I'm just tired of it. And I think now we're in a great position to say, okay, this passed unanimously. Let's get to work. Let's focus on what the issues are, and let's not put the people's health at risk.
Wow, great.
Absolutely. Can you tell us a little bit more about the substance that's kind of at the center of all this, AFFF?
Yes. So, AFFF, which is an acronym, it's like aqueous firefighting foam. And it pretty much is a PFAS chemical, which if you're familiar with PFAS chemicals, they cause a lot of varying diseases, a list of diseases from cancer to reproductive issues to whatever you can think of. And we've seen these effects, especially in the Hoosick Falls area, where we've had that contamination in the drinking water and also the Bennington area. And we first knew about these chemicals in our area because of Bennington College doing a preliminary study about this chemical, and they found significant contamination, which the DEC disagrees with. So we're really just trying to find out what the truth is, and we're really just trying to figure out, okay, this is a really bad chemical. There's not a lot of evidence to suggest that it's good for the area, and there's not a lot of evidence to suggest it's bad. So let's just stop it, because we're not going to put people's lives as guinea pigs, because we've seen if you drink this material, if you drink this chemical, it leads to significant health effects. So if we're breathing it in, you can't convince me that it's okay. Mm-hmm. And mind you, Norlite also burns 400 plus chemicals other than just AFFF. Mm-hmm. And so as we're speaking, I'm sure they're burning right now.
Wow.
Right. It seems like the kind of situation where sort of a precautionary principle would make sense. If you don't know what it's doing and you have reason to suspect it's dangerous, why go ahead? So you started the nonprofit Saratoga Sites Against Norlite Emissions earlier this year. Can you tell us a little bit about what SANE is and what it does?
Sure. So SANE is a nonprofit that I decided to start up because I really want to just get the awareness of this Norlite issue, you know, to the public more, because like I said, for the past 50 years, there's been no coverage of this issue. I think finally we're at a time where we can just propel the issue of Norlite to the spotlight, help the residents of Saratoga sites get and also give them recognition for what they're living in and the situations that they are in, and to say, this is a problem. We have to do something about it. And hopefully, I'm working with the housing authority, we might be able to move the residents out, but that's just a maybe. So, you know, there's a lot of processes going, but this profit is nonprofit here is to really help expand this issue, to really say, this is what the people want. They want, you know, really clean air. They want to breathe clean air, just like the rich neighborhoods miles away. So that's what we're going to do. And if we have to come out with a little bit of force and a little bit of strength, then we're going to do it. And I think that this is a great way to catapult the issues.
Right. Yeah. So can you talk a little bit about the permit renewal process? It seems like that's pretty important to the moment at which this fight is taking place. Can you talk about the permit renewal process, which is currently underway?
Yeah. I mean, I could speak pretty broadly about it because it's extremely technical. DEC, you know, they claim that the public can make comments about it. They can review the processes, but to make an actual effective comment, you really need a lot of experience in this. It's extremely technical. You need lawyers, you need things to even make a dent in this type of issue. And what I've been saying from the very beginning is that the DEC is trying to keep Norlite open. They're saying they're going to treat it as a new permit, which would make the requirements of the permit that they need to get a lot more stringent, a lot more, you know, strict. So, but they're trying to keep the facility open because they're saying, like, well, if they put this permit in, they can prove to us that they can burn fine. They have literally dozens and dozens and dozens of pages of violation after violation after violation, year after year after year. And what I've been trying to say is that the scientists at DEC have said for the past 50 years that the soot, that the dirty air, people getting sick, people having to move because of this issue is okay. And I'm here to say it's not okay. And if you approve this permit, you are enabling Norlite to continue to just utterly destroy the community of Cohoes. I mean, it's just a dump site for these types of companies. Saratoga Sites is in the middle of an industrial area. It's in the middle of a railroad that carries dangerous chemicals. It's next to Norlite. It's next to a paper mill facility. It's next to a main highway. It's next to a gas station. If any one of those things goes horribly wrong, they could all have a catastrophic effect on each other. So, you know I got a little bit abroad about that, but the permit process is something so much more than just the permit. It's just the precedent and how it is.
Well, Joe, Richie, thank you so much for joining us and, you know, keep the fight going. He is executive director of SSANE.
And before you go, can you tell us a little bit
Guy
more?
Guy has about... something else. I'm sorry, yeah. Guy, go ahead.
Before you go, can you tell us a little bit about how can people who are interested in your organizing work learn more or get involved in the fight against Norlite?
Yeah, so Facebook page set up Saratoga Sites Against Norlite Emissions. You can send us a message on there. You could give me a phone call. My number is 518-526-9543. You can even reach out to the Sanctuary for Independent Media. And you can also go on the Lights Out Norlite page on Facebook as well to reach out. We're really starting to build up on our avenue for connections. So it'd be great for someone to reach out.
Joe, can you give us that contact information again?
Sure. You can contact us on Facebook, Saratoga Sites Against Norlite Emissions, and the logo is like a little green leafy logo with SSANE on it. You can give me a call at 518-526-9543. And you can also go on Lights Out Norlite, which is another page on Facebook that we have for these issues.
Thank you, Joe. Keep up the fight. As I said before, he is executive director of SSAN. He is one of the panelists at next week's Norlite Town Hall Signature Edition on Tuesday, November 10th at 7 p.m. To register for this online event and get the Zoom link, go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at info@mediasanctuary.org. Guy, guess what?
Is it that time again?
Can you believe it? It just goes too fast.
I know, the time flies by. That concludes our show. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Guy Schaefer.
And I am Livonia Mallory. And we thank our engineer, Alexis Goldsmith. Hey! Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., 6 p.m. to hear local news. You can find all the stories on today's program at mediasanctuary.org and or our Facebook page at facebook.com/WOOC 105.3 FM. This program is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, mail us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call us at 518-272-2390. And if you value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.